episode 109 of Positive Regression, a motorsports analytics podcast. I'm Alan Cavana, joined as always by David Smith. On this episode, we have a special guest, ARCA and Xfinity Series driver and current driver coach, Michael Self, joined us as we ask how drivers can improve their road course racing skills, that plus, of course, our big Road America preview and what we've learned from the road courses so far. But first, as always, we are starting with a deep dive. This week, in honor of episode 109, we're looking at the longtime owner of the 09 car in the Cup Series, James Finch's Phoenix Racing. David, James Finch, longtime NASCAR owner, known for more stories than success, really, I guess. He was a rich businessman, made it big in construction, and just seemed to love the sport of racing, right? A smorgasbord of drivers throughout the years in both Xfinity and Cup. You know, for some drivers, it almost seems like a rite of passage. You had to take a stint in the Phoenix car. But David, I think the highlight, at least competitively for Phoenix Racing, of course, was the big win with Brad Keselowski at Talladega. Remember that race where Carl Edwards went sailing into the fence? Brad Keselowski told us who he was, and he's been the same driver ever since. But that, David, was a big win for James Finch. What should we know about him?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, that you're right. That was the culmination moment. But really, this started as a Busch Series team, predominantly around Jeff Purvis, and it grew to a part-time Cup Series team. The program had high hopes going into the 1994 season. It was going to be Neil Bonnet's big comeback season. Country Time Lemonade was the sponsor. Hoosier Tires were on the car, but unfortunately, Bonnet was killed during practice for the Daytona 500 that year, and that crucial step forward, it still would have been a limited schedule, but it did not come to pass. So the team pressed forward, part-time basis funded either by Finch's construction company, as you mentioned, or longtime sponsor Miccosukee Casino and Resort. And with that, they started running close to the full schedules in the early 2010s. Only the one win that you mentioned in 251 starts at the Cup Series level. But bet your ass they partied after all 251 of those starts. Or maybe it was just one party and it kept going. But James Finch, with his omnipresent red solo cup, they did things differently. They operated out of Spartanburg, South Carolina. You can actually see the shop from I-85 as you're driving north or south. It is now a Guy Roofing facility. Longtime neighbor of Phoenix Racing and then eventual sponsor. Before that, the shop was occupied by H. Scott Motorsports, who bought the team and the shop from Finch in 2013. But as the team itself went on, this team spent a lot of time as a start and park team when that tactic became popular in and around the economic recession. It went full throttle, though, at Daytona and Talladega. Phoenix Racing did. 11 of their 15 career top 10 finishes came on the drafting tracks. Different drivers in the car: Jeff Bodine, Mike Wallace, Johnny Sauter, Brad Keselowski, as you mentioned, Mike Bliss, Kurt Busch, and Regan Smith. Firstly, I too would require a red solo cup to work with that roster, but each of them did score top 10 finishes on behalf of Phoenix Racing. Johnny Sauter specifically got one for himself in Phoenix, Arizona, Phoenix Raceway in 2005. And then Kurt Busch, I think, had, yeah, if it's not Keselowski's performance, this one at Sonoma, memorable, which he finished third. And basically, the car was broken and smoldering on the racetrack after it was over. But the highlight is Keselowski, and really that win, that step that James Finch provided Keselowski in 2009, just 15 races in the Cup Series for Brad K. Of course, he made some of those with Hendrick Motorsports, but he had a 1.8 peer. That year, it ranked 12th among all drivers that season, and that was before he was officially a Cup rookie. In hindsight, that was a sign of things to come, and a lot of it transpired due to Phoenix Racing and car owner James Finch.
Yes, a lot of big names, maybe not the results, but to trace the history and the names that came through there, it plays a part into their history. That's why it's cool doing some of these deep dives. You mentioned their shop down in Spartanburg. I was there when it was officially H. Scott, but it was still all the remnants of Phoenix Racing. Brad Keselowski's trophy was still there from Talladega. They had a big Elvis in there, just a statue of Elvis. They had a bar inside the shop. I mean, it was still the James Finch era, if you will, inside H. Scott Motorsports a few years ago. So that was always a fun time to see it down there. I'm glad you mentioned the Kurt Busch year, because that was a big deal, right? It was a team that could give opportunity to someone who needed it, right? To someone who needed to be on the track. And we don't see many James Finches anymore, right? A rich guy, loves racing, loves to spend some money, right? And just be at the track and maybe, you know, win the party and not necessarily race. We don't see as much of that anymore, David.
Yeah, and you're right. For a lot of those guys, it was maybe a redemption tour of sorts. I would argue that James Finch was the right owner at the right time when those guys needed it. So, I mean, really, he was almost a way station of sorts. And maybe that's a bit degrading, but he kind of was just a way station, a stopover for some of these drivers that kind of needed to gather their thoughts and move their career forward from there. And it worked, and it lasted a while, and we still talk about them. We remember them, as you mentioned, the stories that we can talk about Phoenix Racing. Are all relevant. Just an interesting time, unique team within the sport. I kind of do hope that we see something like it again, just this free-spirited bunch kind of doing their own thing against the grains of the norm.
Yes, and for more on James Finch, you should Google it, because there's a lot more to the story, both in the past and currently, but we'll cover that in another podcast. But episode 109, dedicated to James Finch's Phoenix Racing. So let's get this episode started. It is always awesome when we have a guest here on Positive Regression, especially somebody who has been behind the steering wheel of a race car. And today on this episode, we have Michael Self. Michael is an 8-time race winner in what's now the ARCA Pro Series West. He won 9 times in the ARCA National Series, made 7 starts, you remember his car, in the Xfinity Series for JD Motorsports back in 2017. And now he's the general manager of Silverhair Racing, a team competing in Trans-Am's TA2 series. But Michael, first of all, thank you for joining us. We want you here on the podcast because you are also a driver coach / performance advisor. A little slash there on the title. How did that come to be, working with other drivers and trying to enhance their skills?
Yeah, well, first off, thank you. That was an awesome introduction, by the way. You nailed it. Hit all those stats out of the park right there. But thank you guys for having me on. It's great to be here. The coaching thing has been something I'm going to go way back on a little bit to when I was, I think 17 or 18 years old. And I grew up out in Salt Lake City, Utah, and our local track out there at the time was Miller Motorsports Park. And they had the Ford Racing School, which was really the only school backed by Ford in the United States at the time. It was basically for whoever, right? If you were an everyday person, you wanted to come get experience on a racetrack, you could come to our 1-day schools, 2-day schools. There were hot lap, events where you'd run for 3 hours and just get time in a race car on a racetrack. I got the opportunity to coach out there, being a local from the track, and it was something that I always really, really enjoyed. It was fun for me to get outside the race car and share my knowledge with people who maybe didn't know anything about racing, right? It was, you just take it down to such a basic level and people are enthralled by that. They're interested in that. And that really got me hooked on working with people, kind of thinking about racing in my own way a little bit differently, I guess, because you're always teaching someone something a little bit different, or someone's got a different perspective on it. And that was always really, really cool to me, along with sharing my passion. So I started working out at the school. And then when I moved to North Carolina, that was in 2014. I started coaching a little bit for, if you guys remember, H. Scott Motorsports at the time, Mike Greachy over there was a good friend of mine, and he hooked me up with a couple drivers right there off the bat. One of which was Justin Haley. And so Justin Haley ran for H. Scott. I guess it was 2015 was his first year. We went over there and knew he was going to run for the K&N Championship. They signed me up to be his driver coach and spotter for that entire year, but he also bought a Trans-Am TA2 car. And I remember going down to Sebring early. You know, I hadn't heard of the TA2 series. Mm-hmm. I was very familiar with Trans Am from Trans Am back in the 70s. But as far as I was concerned, it was a little bit dead, so to speak. You know, there wasn't big car counts. It wasn't something that was still a big series or something that was very well known. And so we went down to Sebring early in the year. I think it was January. They just bought this TA2 car. And they were like, you know, it's very similar to the K&N car. Come take a look at it. And I remember I got down there and I was like, I'm going to jump in this thing. I'm going to take over your car for a minute. And I'm just going to learn what this thing is all about. And I remember getting in it and making just a handful of laps, you know, 4 or 5 laps. And I was like, this is just like the K&N car. I was like, this is very, very similar. At the time, they were both running a bias ply tire, very similar construction tire. The weight was the same. I think the TA2 car at the time was about 400 or 500 pounds less than the K&N car was. And it just drove very, very familiar to what I've been racing in the K&N series up to that point. And so I said, man, this is, everyone should be doing this, right? There's like immediately, there's nothing better for guys that want to learn road racing in NASCAR than this. This is awesome. And so went throughout that season with Justin and coached him. He ran, I think, 5 or 6 TA2 races, the full K&N championship. The next year he ran for both championships, the TA2 championship as well as the K&N championship. Of course, he won the K&N East championship that year. I think we finished second or third in the TA2 series points. And about that time is when I saw TA2 really starting to catch on. I think more guys were seeing, whether they were seeing that Justin was doing it or they were just becoming more aware of it. You had Matt Tiff started to come over and dabble in it a little bit. I think about that time, you know, Ty Dillon had done a little bit of it. So fast forward a little bit, you know, Justin moves up to go run the truck series. I decided to stay with the TA2 stuff. And in 2017, I think is when you really started to see guys take note. I think that's the year when Christopher Bell came in and started doing a little bit of it. Harrison Burton started to do a little bit of it. Matt Tift was there. And it just kind of grew over the next couple of years to what the series is now, is a great home for development. And for me, it's been something that I've been able to make a home for myself, coaching guys and sticking with that initial philosophy of these things are so similar to the K&N cars or even the Xfinity cars or the ARCA cars. This is something that guys really need to take advantage of. And it's been fun to see it grow and the series get more exposure and notoriety because of that.
Michael, you mentioned Christopher Bell. You know, for a driver like him, all world in terms of dirt racing, and then makes the decision that he wants to go stock car racing. It's already a little bit out of his wheelhouse, but he knew that going in. What he didn't know going in was that he would be driving a lot of road courses based on this year's schedule change. So for a driver like him, he doesn't come to you with prior road racing experience, but clearly he's elite in another discipline of auto racing. So it is not as if you are working with a novice. How big then is the learning curve for somebody like a Christopher Bell? Are you starting from scratch, or can you build off of the foundation that's already there?
I think every driver you can utilize the foundation, but it's really interesting to see how the foundation is different. Let's take two guys I'm very familiar with, Harrison Burton and Christopher Bell, two guys I've worked a ton with. You know, Christopher's foundation was that, like we talked about, David, when you wrote your article, his first time in the car was go out, the thing gets sideways, you stand on the gas, he's driving it like a sprint car. I mean, it was just what you'd imagine. It was almost like video game speed, right? It's like there was no real solid mentality behind it. It was just go fast by whatever means. There was no solid methodology. And I remember he came in after his first session and I was like, you're fast, but don't get used to it because it's not going to last the way that you're doing it right now. This is a sprint car. You can't just burn the rear tires off the thing. But the speed was obviously right there. And then we look over at Harrison Burton. Harrison is very methodical. Harrison has the foundation of, you know, Harrison doesn't tear stuff up very often. Harrison kind of works his way up to things. I think throughout his entire career that I've watched, you know, he may start the weekend a little more timid than other guys, but by the end of it, he's always there on pace. So you look at those two and say, look, every driver has the foundation. It's just the foundation is so much different for each one. And that's where I feel like I've really been able to capitalize, is is understanding that and understanding those differences and tapering to those differences for each driver and listening to them, you know, listening to what kind of feedback they like, what kind of feedback works for them. And that's, I think, the most important part of coaching guys.
From a driver and a coach's perspective, we hear about all the tools drivers have at their disposal. The sim rigs that all the manufacturers provide. I know drivers watch a lot of tape. You know, sometimes younger guys are watching the cup guys, like a Kevin, like the entire race of a Kevin Harvick in car or something like that, right? We've heard some drivers, you know, make laps at GoPro Motorplex, all that stuff. What is the best tool for learning for a driver? Since you've both been a driver and a coach, what can drivers utilize the best to help them, especially for a track they've never been to?
So, you know, man, that's a tough question because everyone is going to be different. I mean, you've got guys out there that live by the simulator and, you know, Toyota's simulator, for example, which I've been fortunate enough to try out a handful of times. It actually didn't work at all for me because I got extremely sick when I was using it. The motion sickness I would get was terrible when I was using the Toyota simulator. So I was able to run a handful of laps on it. And I remember getting out my first time being like, there's just no way, you know, I can't do this. I've got iRacing sims, you know, I've got an iRacing sim at home, just a little stable, you know, solid seat set up on a TV screen. But when I put on the 3D glasses and the motion sim, it just didn't work at all for me. So that was never worthwhile. And for me, the problem with sim driving was always that there was a disconnect. My brain always told me that this isn't real. This is a video game and there's no penalty. There's nothing wrong. You know, you cut the course, you run into the wall, you just reset it. That was always a little bit hard for me. iRacing was good as far as learning a new track, but it was something that I wasn't going to spend a lot of time on because I was always afraid of developing bad habits. But you know, there's guys out there that, like I said, they live by that. I mean, Bell loves the sim. He's on it all the time and is able to make really, really positive gains off it. For me, I was more of the video guy. I remember back at Charlotte, I think it was in 2019, when ran the ARCA test there and we were fast, had a ton of speed, but I just felt a little bit off. I felt there wasn't something that was quite right. So I actually, it's coincidental that you mentioned it. I went back and that night after the test, I watched a lot of Kevin Harvick footage from the cup race there. And I noticed that Kevin was taking a much narrower entry into turn 1 and 3 than I was, much straighter. And so as soon as we got back for the race, I tried that and it worked. I mean, for me, went out, qualified on the pole, dominated the majority of the race, had an incident late in it, but everyone's a little bit different. You know, my personal feeling is there's no substitute for actual seat time. So if you can get on the track, let's say it's a road course, which a lot of guys don't have a lot of experience, and you experience that, you can go to a place like COTA that's so difficult, or a place like Mid-Ohio that's very technical, and you can make laps in something like a TA2 car. Personally, there's just no replacement for that, especially in the TA2 stuff. We're very fortunate to have the cars fully outfitted with AIM data systems. So we can hook up sensors to pretty much whatever we want to. We can get brake data, throttle data, steering input data, you know, yaw data off the cars. And for the engineers, that's great. But also as a coach, that's tremendously valuable to me because we've also got video cameras inside the car that run all the time. So when a driver comes off, I can go watch their entire session from the onboard camera and overlay that with data and go, you know, look, here's what I'm seeing on the data. I match that with the video. You know, why are you slow in this corner? Because the data says this. When we overlay with the video, okay, well, you're turning in early, your roll speed's slow, you know, your angle isn't quite right. And so the feedback that I've gotten is, hey, that's invaluable, because it's such accurate feedback. It's something the drivers can work on and correct, and are getting feedback and accurate feedback right there that it's really beneficial. And I think the sims, the really good ones, have tried to replicate that as far as having data on there. But again, there's just, for me, there's always that little disconnect that's just not, it's not real. It's not 100% right.
Michael, with the increased road course schedule for the Cup Series, the entire stock car racing ecosystem is rocked, essentially. And unless ARCA changes dramatically the schedule and lowers its cost, there is now this unfilled need for road racing at the development levels. And you've done a very good job of selling TA2. I recently wrote about NASCAR Euro becoming this affordable alternative pipeline, but you're firmly in the TA2 series. Where can it go from here? Can young drivers go there now and maybe do more, even if they can't afford to supplement their oval experience in ARCA or trucks, can they do enough and accomplish enough in TA2 to become valuable road racers at the Cup Series level?
Yeah, I really hope so. And I do think so. I'm a huge advocate for TA2 for all the reasons that I just mentioned, because I've seen it firsthand have such a positive impact on a lot of the NASCAR guys. And when I assumed the role of general manager at Silverhair Racing this year, I said, look, guys, TA2 has a great market right now. We're only going to get more road courses on the NASCAR schedule. You know, I firmly believe that in a couple of years, we'll have possibly 10 or more road courses on the Cup schedule. And there has to be, like you said, that affordable outlet. TA2, I think, is still at a price point where a guy can come in and he can either run a race weekend or a guy can run a full series and it doesn't just break the bank. You know, I know it's significantly more affordable than running an ARCA car. And I think, you know, TA2, I think you only have to be 15 to compete full time in it. So we get that question. I get that question and think through that a lot. You know, do you take a young kid and say he's got go-kart experience or some dirt car experience, maybe some junior late model experience. You face the reality that as of right now, you can't really compete in trucks or Xfinity until you're 18, right? You can only run a handful of the schedules. So what do you do? Do you put them in an ARCA car and go run the Berlins and the Elkos and the South Bostons in a heavy stock car and get that kind of short track experience? Or do you run a TA2 car, which is also a heavy stock car on the road courses, which are a lot of road courses that they're going to run in the future. The issue that I come up with there is that you're going to be paying, you know, sometimes $60,000, maybe more, to go run South Boston in an ARCA car, where you can pay $25,000 to $30,000 to go run Road America in a TA2 car. And Road America is a track that's probably going to be on the NASCAR schedule at some level of NASCAR for years to come. You're probably going to go race against the Christopher Bells and the good NASCAR guys that are running that event, as well as some of the best road racers in the country, in my opinion. And you know, I would say let the driver decide for themselves. You know, let the parents or the young driver or the funded driver make that decision. You know, what do they think is going to be the most beneficial. You know, I remember when I was young, when I ran the Canaan West series, the only really relevant tracks that we raced for Xfinity or ARCA or trucks were Iowa, Phoenix, and Sonoma. You know, outside of that, we raced Roseville, we raced Stockton, we raced Irwindale. And it was great. It was great getting short track experience. But I remember the first time I got into a mile and a half, I was kind of like, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I have no idea what I'm doing here. Yeah, I'm still in a big, heavy stock car, but this doesn't really translate to what I've been doing in the past. And so, like I said, everyone's going to be different. You know, I don't have a firm answer of which one is going to be the best. I stick by the TA2 and I vouch for it. I've seen a combination of the two be really, really good in Justin Haley's case when he ran the K&N series and the TA2 series. I saw him improve as a driver dramatically that year because he was getting so much experience on different tracks every single weekend, different style tracks. His adaptability skills really, really grew. And that's something I think is really important as a driver.
Good stuff. Good perspective on that because we are going to Road America where a lot of us, I mean, myself, I've never been there. I've only seen it from afar. I'm certainly not a driver. So using your coaching theme of making it as basic as possible for us and our listeners, Michael, what matters? What do you want the car to be able to do at Road America? Give us some finer points that we should be thinking of this weekend.
So Road America, in my opinion, is a very aero-dependent track, very much the opposite of Mid-Ohio, in my opinion. Mid-Ohio is very technical, very tight corners, very, very slow, a lot of first gear corners, where Road America is a lot of fast, sweeping corners. It's Road America rewards the guy that drives really, really hard, i.e. Christopher Bell winning in the Xfinity car a couple of years ago. That's kind of what I look at there. And you know, I work on with data on guys there. I always look at roll speed. It's really easy for guys to overslow the corners at Mid-Ohio. There's a lot of, at Road America, a lot of very hard braking zones. It's huge. I mean, what is it? It's 2.20-ish seconds, I think, in a TA2 car around there. And I, you know, there's what, one or two first gear corners, I think. So you just work on roll speed. You work on those attributes that a guy like Christopher Bell has of knowing the threshold in the middle of a corner, how much roll speed and momentum can you carry? And that definitely plays a major factor there at Road America.
Last thing, Michael, and this is just a hypothetical for you. Last week, Tyler Reddick said that he wished there was not practice this weekend before the Cup Series race at Road America, because all the recent Xfinity Series drivers that have been there would have at least a leg up for as long as it took the Cup Series guys to figure the place out. There is obviously a practice session, so we're not going to see this, but I'm curious, how long do you think it would take somebody like Martin Truex or Denny Hamlin to figure out Road America in a live race situation? How quickly could that happen?
Well, so I'm going to answer your question, then I'm going to have a follow-up for you guys, actually. You know, when you're talking about Denny Hamlin or Martin Truex or those guys, I don't know, 3-4 laps, you know, those guys are just so good. And I go back to adaptability. They're going to figure it out right away. Those guys have done some sim work. They've watched video. They know the layout of the track. You know, their threshold is so high on what they know the car is capable of and what they're capable of. They're just going to pick it up, you know, really quickly right off the bat. But I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but, you know, this is a, like I said, this is a big weekend for us at Silver Hair. We're going into Road America for the TA2 race. We race on Saturday after the Xfinity race. We've got Christopher Bell and Harrison Burton are going to be racing with us. But last week, NASCAR came out and said, so we have a Thursday practice session. I believe it's a total of about 2.5 hours of practice just in the TA2 cars. Then we have a 20-minute qualifying session on Friday. NASCAR released something that said, if you're going to run the TA2 practice day on Thursday, you must make a strong attempt, or basically what they see as a legitimate effort, to also race the race on Saturday, the TA2 race. Uh-huh. NASCAR is not going to allow drivers to run just the TA2 practice day on Thursday, which we were thrown for a loop by that one. That definitely took us off guard. It was interesting to see NASCAR kind of come in and say, you know, put the hammer down on something that's been happening for years. Yeah. You know, for every year that we've gone to Road America and Mid-Ohio, we've had guys that just run the early practice, the practice day. And so that was interesting to see how that came into effect. And we're fortunate, you know, we're prepared to make the changes. And we had a couple guys that were only going to run the practice day. One of them bailed out. One of them being Harrison's now just going to run the entire weekend with us. And we're lucky at Silver Hair to be able to do that. But I thought that was NASCAR's perspective on it was basically, we don't allow guys to just run practice in the truck and not run the truck race. Why would we allow it to happen to another series? So it's just kind of an interesting thing to swirl on and to think about that's going on right there.
Yeah,
that is a good nugget for the weekend. All right, good stuff. Michael Self, thank you so much for joining us. Winner, driver, performance enhancer. Can we call you that, Michael? Is that?
Yeah,
that
I like it. I like all that. Right. That's
Michael
good.
Self, performance enhancer, new business card for you.
Yeah. Oh, I appreciate it. And thank you guys. Definitely check out the TA2 race this weekend. You know, we're ecstatic. We've had a great year so far with Silver Hair. We're definitely building on things. Excited to have Christopher Bell and Harrison Burton racing alongside Tyler Casera and Maurice Hull this weekend up there. I think we've got 38 to 40 cars on the entry list. The TA2 stuff puts on an awesome show. I mean, you're watching the top 10 guys, some of the best road racers in the country, and, you know, really good comparison for the NASCAR guys and how they're going to run on Sunday or Saturday compared to how the TA2 guys race on Saturday afternoon. And they usually put on an awesome event. So I urge everyone to check it out and keep up with it.
Excellent insight. Michael Self, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
What a way to get into our Road America preview, David, because, you know, hearing from a driver, hearing what they're preparing for and all that, it only goes along with what we've been talking about much of the years, because there are so many road courses on the schedule. This one being a new one for many of the drivers. Cup Series, never been at Road America in the modern era, if you will. So let's start our preview off for Road America by talking about all the road courses, David. So far, what we've learned this season, because we've had three of the races so far. Has anything surprised you so far into the road course schedule?
Yes, but it's not statistical. It's the level of buy-in. And maybe this is just small sample, purely qualitative stuff, but it seems from the drivers and team members that I've talked with that road courses, the expanded schedule, and specifically COTA, they were all up for it. COTA as an event had a lot of issues. All of them were weather related, which I think is a shame because it sounded as if just from preparation, game planning, everyone had something up their sleeves, ready to go, ready to try. And we didn't get to see that race. We saw another race, a rain-soaked race. But a dry race at COTA for NASCAR was and still is something that I look forward to seeing because of the collective buy-in, the additional training, as we talked with Michael Self about. I don't think that was totally the case with the Bristol Dirt Race, between the skeptical drivers, the crew chiefs sort of just shrugging on setups that might work. There was none of that with COTA or for Road America this weekend. These tracks are new to the Cup Series schedule, but I'm impressed they are already held in very high regard.
All right. I like that perspective on it. I was just thinking, you know, what surprised me is, you know, coming into the season, right? And maybe it was naive, of course, but you're just thinking baseline results. But you just thought Chase Elliott, Martin Truex Jr., right? Going to dominate everything. I don't think we've seen that. I mean, we've maybe in, if you look at some of the statistics, I know you tweeted out some good numbers about Martin Truex Jr. and his passing, but in the results, like Chase Elliott won the rain race at COTA, but maybe it's not so much the lack of domination, but we have seen some new players at these road courses. I think maybe that has surprised me, is that it has not been the 9 and 19 show in the first three races.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and I think some of it does circle back from, you know, look, Christopher Bell won it, the Daytona road course race. Well, he's been taking it upon himself to become a better road racer ever since he stepped foot in NASCAR. And really a lot of these drivers have, and now that is coming to the surface. They're doubling down on whatever tool that they use to get better, whether it's sim racing, whether it's getting in the seat of another car and learning, whether it's asking questions, what have you. But now, because of the expanded schedule, I think we're entering a world in which if you're bad at road racing, I don't think you can hack it in the Cup Series. If we're just going to continue adding more races, it's going to become more and more of a skill that requires prevalence across all different road course facilities. All of them are unique, of course, but I think what you're hitting on is kind of the way things are going to have to be moving forward.
All right. That's fair. Now, that's one side, right? I mean, who was kind of impressed or maybe surprised us? There's a flip side to that. Who's disappointed a little bit? David, top of my list, only because of the results. I would say I'm a little disappointed in William Byron, because when I look at Motorsports Analytics, I look at his speed on road courses. He's ninth in speed. He's had speed at road courses. You've talked about it on this podcast for a long time. He's had poles. He's been very good at road courses. But then you look at points scored, David, 24th in the three races. He is 24th in points scored. That just seems like a missed opportunity to me.
Yeah, that's a good shout. The Sonoma race was a tough one for him. You know, for me personally, it's kind of similar along those lines. Ryan Blaney, and it's just based on what I've seen from him this year. He's finished 15th, 17th, and 10th, which is okay. But no single race point total greater than 27. But Allen, in terms of just being able to move through traffic, he's at an elite level. He's the second most efficient passer this season on road courses. And someone who can move that efficiently across any road course track should not have just one top 10 finish. He should not rank just 14th in points earned from road course races. And I think the culprit is it's sort of easy to identify. His car isn't particularly fast. He ranks 16th in median lap time, 25th in average best lap time. He can't even get a whiff of clean air. Get him a car, please, because clearly this is a driver able to do a lot of heavy lifting, and there's nothing else at his disposal right now. He should be contending for wins in Cup Series road course races. And instead, it's rare when he finishes 10th.
You mentioned the drivers don't really have the option to not be good anymore, right, at road courses. So in terms of disappointments, I'm going to throw Austin Dillon in again. He came into this year with zero top 10s on road courses. He still has zero top 10s on road courses. And look, every other place, you can look at the point standings. He's knocking it out of the park. Great start to the season. But eventually, David, I mean, it's got to come around. You would think, I mean, if you want to compete, as you were saying, you have to come around and improve your road racing skills. Still on zero top 10. So even though there wasn't as much expected of him, I still have him on my disappointed list.
Yeah. And if you're bringing that to your team, if you're good elsewhere, I mean, you're almost going to have to be just dynamite elsewhere to make up for your shortcomings on road courses. And I'll commend him. It's been a good season to date for Austin Dillon and the three team, but it hasn't been that good to make up for what has been lost in the road course races. And that sort of is going to go for any driver. I mean, if we're adding street courses and looking at more road courses and maybe building more road courses, I don't know. Yeah, this is a skill that you can't ignore anymore. You know, we had a laugh when Kevin Harvick was incredibly skeptical about Bristol dirt. But also, it's a one-off race. You can't really fault him for thinking the way that he thought. He didn't really sign up to be a dirt racer. Not much adaptation is required if we're only going there once a year. But that excuse doesn't exist with the road courses. So these races, and while there isn't enough playoff representation to warrant the championship teams going it all in, trying to figure out how to dominate at these places, it's still crucial. And there are still, I mean, you've pointed this out repeatedly this year. These are opportunities where guys in the middle of the pack, in the bottom of the pack, can surprise and win. You know, just imagine if AJ Allmendinger was running full time. Just imagine if somebody like a James Davison had far better equipment than what he had at his disposal. This is the low-hanging fruit. So you have those guys just sort of waiting for that opportunity. Yeah, we've come to a point where you can't be bad on road courses, at least for an extended period of time, and get away with it. But I share your disappointment in Austin Dillon only because it really wasn't until this year that this became a thing. And if he improves, and that could start this weekend, then that's sort of a new narrative for him moving forward.
But to that front of overachieving, I'm shouting out guys like Chase Briscoe, Eric Jones, Chris Buescher. When you look at their points scored, David, on the three road courses, you know, they're in the teens, right? They're just outside the top 10 in terms of points scored. That's far outdoing what they're doing for the season as a whole. You know what I'm saying? So they seem to be taking advantage of these road course opportunities. So I want to give those three drivers a shout out because there is a noticeable jump when you look at points scored. In terms of ones who can maybe turn themselves around this weekend, I mentioned William Byron, the results not matching the speed. Would that be a case of potential positive regression, David? Maybe William Byron can throw it down this weekend.
I feel like all four Hendrick Motorsports cars can probably do that at this point. I think it's kind of like what we saw at Pocono. Maybe one or two cars had just unbelievable raw speed, but there was enough elsewhere. And at Pocono, it was within the strategy. I mean, you could just go off sequence and all of a sudden you were formidable for the race win. Well, I think the same scenario will exist this weekend with a lot of teams. The Chip Ganassi Racing teams, I feel really good about, not necessarily because of speed, but because of driver ability and what they have displayed this year with strategy. That might be enough to make up the difference. And the flip side of that is if you are William Byron or Chase Elliott or Kyle Larson or Alex Bowman, then you can't have any mistake. You can't have a vulnerability because you're going to have everyone behind you go off sequence to you in an effort to pass you. So there's a lot that can go wrong. Often it doesn't, especially right now for Hendrick Motorsports, but that's kind of the thing that you have to worry about.
All right. Well, given all that we've talked about, David, We've heard from Michael Self. We've talked a little bit about the road courses as a whole. Who is your pick to win? And give me a specific reason why this weekend.
The most efficient road course passer in 2019 was Martin Truex. The most efficient road course passer in 2020 was Martin Truex.
Oh.
Through three road course races this year, the most efficient passer is Martin Truex. The driver with the highest retention rate on double file restarts on road courses, and that rate, I kid you not, is 100%.
Wow.
Is Martin Truex. That is going to be my pick. Now, is he going to have the fastest car? That I have no idea. Hendrick Motorsports' road course program appears to be a notch above what Truex has right now with Joe Gibbs Racing. That might be true. It might not. But it is inarguable the influence that Martin Truex has in NASCAR road course races. He is legitimately great at this, at this particular discipline. And I just can't see how he won't impact this race somehow. And I am betting on that impact.
All right. He is a fifth in terms of road course speed, but ninth in terms of points scored. So a little work to be done there. Maybe some positive regression if he can live up to that speed and take advantage of all those passing numbers and stats. I like your pick, David, but I'm going with someone different. I'm going with the 22 car, Joey Logano. Looking at the stats, he has the best production. He is the best pure performer on 750 tracks so far this year. One of the best passers on road courses as well this year. And he scored more points than anyone on road courses so far this year. He has three top fives in the three races. So, David, I'm playing the odds, putting it together, and I'm going with the 22. And I made this pick before we talked to Michael Self, and the fact that Michael Self said Road America rewards the aggressive drivers, I like my pick even more now.
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you feel great. No, look, Logano was, he has been in contention at, well, until Sonoma, was in contention at COTA, the Daytona road course, both the points race and the Busch Clash. So it seems like dating back to last year with that Roval race, that the road course ways of Logano have turned around after, I don't know, kind of a year or so swoon in that department. I think it's a good pick. And as we said, I don't know that it's going to come down to just, even if he doesn't have, I know he has good 750 speed, but even if he just isn't on par with Hendrick, there are ways to work around that. And just because of that, I feel good about a lot of these guys up front. I think this could be a fun race, even if someone just goes out and yards it and is gone from second to 10th. I don't really know where to go. So that's why I'm going to bet big on the guy that I know can influence this regardless of whatever else happens. But I also like your choice of Logano.
All right. Well, those are our picks to win. How about a contrarian performer for us, David? Who you got?
Ryan Preece, and I'm focused on the passing here as well. He ranks as the fifth most efficient passer this year on road courses. His JTG Racing team, at this point, I never really know what I'm going to get from them, but Preece does take to these tracks very well. I think Trent Owens can map this race out strategically. He is a +7 on positions earned this season through green flag pit stops on road courses, coupled with Preece's ability to pass. I feel okay. I feel pretty good about their shot this weekend. They just have got to build. Preece did race once at Road America. He finished 11th in 2016 driving for JD Motorsports. So, he did. He has experience in relative back marker equipment at this very racetrack. So I think that might be a place where you can have some application.
All right. Good stuff. My contrarian pick for the second week in a row, David, Ross Chastain. It didn't work out so well last week, which was disappointing, not only for me, but obviously him, of course, and the 42 team. But for a lot of the same reasons I picked Logano for the win, I'm picking Ross as my contrarian performer. Again, when it comes to road courses this season, he moves up in every metric compared to the rest of the season, right? He has a better production on road courses than overall. He's a better passer on road courses than overall. This is what the stats say. His car is faster on road courses than overall. Points scored, all that stuff. So I'm taking him again, second week in a row, and hopefully that bad luck bug doesn't hit him, because we saw what he did in COTA. He's been good momentum lately. I hope he gets it back this weekend. He is my contrarian pick for the road course at Road America. We'll see what he can do. All right, good episode, David. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Luminary, TuneIn, and YouTube. We are available no matter your device. Our entire back catalog of episodes is available for free at posrecpod.com. If you like what you're hearing, please leave a rating or a review. This stuff helps spread the word. We, of course, notice. It is so appreciated. If you have questions, we'd love to hear them. We'd love to answer them, actually. Reach out on Twitter at posrecpod, P-O-S-R-E-G-P-O-D. David, you're always working hard. What do you got this week?
This week for NBC Sports, writing about Tyler Reddick and the driver that he is becoming. He is now very close to being viable across all track types. Also, I will have a Road America race preview on Sunday morning. So follow along on Twitter at David Smith MA to stay on top of all of that.
All right, good stuff. As always, make sure you hit up my social media accounts at Alan Cavana on Twitter. Every Thursday, we get you set for the race weekend, not only in NASCAR, but across all forms of motorsports. With our quick hits video from Speed Sport, we do another one on Tuesday, reviewing the weekend. So just make sure you keep it on there. And of course, watch Fantasy Live. Remember to set your lineup, FantasyLiveNASCAR.com. Myself and Amy Long will try to provide you with some good advice for the weekend about who to start. It's getting to that crunch time where you don't have many good starts left, so you may have to start someone other than Kyle Larson because you're out of them or you want to save them. We got good advice for you. Make sure you watch that. Again, just hook it up on my social media channels. You'll see it all. But another good episode. Glad to have Michael Self. Thank him for joining us once again. For David Smith, I'm Alan Cavana. This is Positive Regression.